Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. In this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, whose books include A Short History of War, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about why the British found the Boers so difficult to defeat, and whether the conflict in South Africa introduced new means of waging and combating guerrilla warfare.
We're going to talk today about the Boer War, more correctly, the Second Boer War, between the British and the Afrikaner republics of Southern Africa, the Transvaal and the Orange Free State, a war that was waged from 1899 to 1902. Let's just start off by giving a bit of background. And I think the background I would be seeking is this, that always when you discuss history, military history is no different to any other branch in this respect, always when you discuss history, there is the problem about how far you aggregate or plump together wars or any other phenomena, which by their nature are specific to themselves. That's a problem if you're looking at things at the time. If we're, let's say, talking about wars in the 20 years before World War I broke out in 1914. But they're also a problem if we go in for what's called diachronic history. In other words, history in which people make comparisons across time. We saw that very much the case in Britain yesterday. We're currently handling this on Thursday, a week ago. But we saw that very much when a prominent backbencher cited a speech from 1940, very much in a given context when it was given in 1940, in order to take it into a very different context in 2022, seemingly at the same time unaware that the 1940 speech was a quotation from a military dictator, to wit, Oliver Cromwell, purging the House of Commons and closing it down. So, but we could leave that aside to just point that all comparisons, and I'm as lazy as most other people in this respect, though I try not to be, are flawed. So, where does this take us from the point of view of the Boer War? Well, where it takes us is there is a tendency to look at the wars in the 20 or 30 or 10 or 15, you pick your number, years before World War I, as prefiguring World War I. There are a number of problems with that. I mean, the obvious one being that although there was much foreboding about the possibility of a major war between the great powers, more particularly after the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 to 1905, nevertheless, people did not appreciate that anything of the scale of World War I was coming, or very few people did. And it was generally believed that even if there was a major war in the offing, that the war would actually be quite a quick one because the powers would not be able to sustain the casualty rates that were anticipated as likely to arise. Certainly in the case of the Boer War, and the Spanish-American War, or indeed some of the other wars of that period, such as the British conquest of Sudan between 1895 and 1900, people did not, as it were, think they were fighting wars that were going to be similar to a rerun with modern weapons of shall we say, the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to 1871. So how should we instead consider these wars? How should we space them together? Well, what I would like to propose, and as I've said, each war is distinctive, but I'm trying to think of a commonality here, is rather than see them as prefiguring World War I, we should see them as wars of a certain stage of imperialism. Now, imperialism, everybody goes shock horror this day and age. That's because they're rather naive and because they don't realise that we live in a world in which imperialism is practised at the present moment. It's just we don't call them wars of imperialism. When Nigeria, for example, suppressed Biafran separatism, that was imperialism. When India drove Pakistan from Bangladesh, that was imperialism. These were states trying to control weaker neighbours or weaker bodies within them who wished for separatism. So, you know, let us get away from any kind of pejorative notion. That's not terribly helpful. But what I would argue is this, that in the 19th century, as we discussed last week, there is a pattern of grouping together wars, particularly wars of the 1870s and 1880s, as wars of imperialism, and indeed taking that into the 1890s with, for example, the French conquest of Madagascar in the mid-1890s, or as I've already indicated, the British conquest of Sudan. And what I would like to suggest is that without proposing any commonality of necessarily goal, there was a commonality that the Second Boer War should be seen as imperial in their own way. In the case of the Second Boer War, you have a new stage of the imperial jockeying in southern Africa. Britain and the Boers had already fought a war, the so-called First Boer War, though it's usually forgotten, in 1881, and there'd been a jockeying in between. And the Second Boer War really emerged from that context. And in considering them as imperial wars, I think one gets a sense of rationalizing what's often the mismatch between contestants, combatants, also, as in the British and the Boers, a mismatch often in the degree of significance for one and the other power. It was very significant for the Boers. It was very significant in southern Africa. Actually, in the big picture of British power at the time, Britain was pursuing a number of great power goals around the world, and southern Africa was only one of them. So there's a mismatch, as there is in most imperial struggles. And then lastly, I think it's worth bearing in mind that one could call it late imperialism, because while allowing for my point last time that one shouldn't overemphasize technology, there is a different technological stage to, shall we say, the wars of the 1860s, 1870s.
Well, Professor Black, I'm interested in this idea of these being imperial conflicts, but imperial conflicts between two colonist settler powers. In the Southern Africa case, the Dutch-speaking Afrikaner, the Boers, and the British. Can you just give a little bit of context how Cape Colony, which is now within South Africa, became British, what the Dutch presence in Southern Africa was, and how we got to the situation of between the 1860s and the 1880s when the two came into conflict?
Excellent. Yes, I'm very happy to do that. Can I first draw out your initial point, which I agree with entirely? This is a struggle between two imperial powers. And can I make the point that that is more generally true of European colonialism and imperialism? There is this very antiquated attack on and critique of Western imperialism as if the rest of the world was in some marvelous context of free-speaking and free-living people in some kind of national sovereignty, which, of course, is complete drivel. Often, Britain got involved. I'm not saying that these decisions were necessarily sensible or not, but often they got involved against other expansionist imperial powers or expansionist forces. We've already mentioned last time the Mahdist of Sudan. There are other instances. For example, and you can look at this in my book on British foreign policy 1783 to 93, when the British established their first base in what is now Malaysia at Georgetown in 1786, that was as a response of the local Sultan wanting support against southward expansion against him from Thailand, and so on and so forth. There are, expansionism is par for the course, and it ought to be mentioned that the expansionists in Africa are not simply other people of European descent, as is true of the Boers, that the Boers were actually pretty unusual in that respect. Most of the expansionist powers were either European power or African powers. Okay. You ask about the Dutch. The Dutch established a base at what is now Cape Town on the route to India. The route to India, of course, went round southern Africa. It was necessary to have places for ships to recuperate, to take on water, and take on food. And, you know, that helped to establish the significance of places in the long term, like Tristan da Cunha, Ascension Island, Mauritius, Réunion, the initial French base in Madagascar, and also Cape Town. And that meant it became a target when Britain and the Dutch fought after the Dutch were taken over by revolutionary France in 1795. Britain attacked and conquered Cape Town, Cape Colony, and then gave it back in the Peace of Amiens, 1802. And then when war resumed, they captured it again. So I think it's fair to say that then you've got a British colony established. Initially, relations with the colonists are not too bad, but eventually there is what is known as the Great Trek. The Boers, most of the Boers, the those of Dutch descent, yet generally known as Afrikaans, but sometimes of Boers, as Boers move into areas, basis of the Orange Free Strait and Transvaal, to be outside the scope of British power. And this is not an enormous issue for the British as an imperial power, but it becomes more significant as Southern Africa becomes more significant.
Mm-hmm. So in the 1860s, we have a gold rush in Transvaal, which is a Boer, how would you describe Transvaal? A Boer colony, a Boer settlement?
I'd say it's a settlement colony, rather like the British in Australia.
So can it be said that the British and the Boers rubbed up against each other in Transvaal partly as a consequence, well, largely as a consequence of the minerals, diamonds, gold that lay under the soil? And you know, this is a struggle for resources.
Well, I think a struggle for resources is an element. I mean, there are other aspects of it. There is the British control about their strategic interests in Southern Africa as part of the broader both route to India and Indian Ocean world. There is anxiety, as we mentioned last time, that the Boers would cooperate with the Germans, who'd established themselves in Southwest Africa and who had ambitious interests in the Portuguese colony of Mozambique. So there is the geostrategic competition we spoke of last time. There is also the complexity of another thing we talked about last time, which is the role of lobbies. And in this case, there were some British interests who were concerned to strengthen the British position and expand it in Southern Africa. I think it's fair to say that, like most imperial lobbies, they represented a minority interest, but nevertheless, precisely because government in the centre only had the time to engage in so many issues at the same time, it was often the case that people at the peripheries, governors in particular colonies, as in British policy in Nigeria, for example, was exactly the same, were very significant. And here we're looking at Milner in South Africa and his ambitious expectations.
What was the cause of the First Boer War, which was really a four-month, relatively short conflict?
Well, I think it's very clearly that was Britain trying to dominate the situation. I think you're right that the resources of the area appeared significant. It also seemed necessary to stabilize Southern Africa after the war with the Zulu. And I think it should be seen as part and parcel of that rather than as a separate issue. And indeed, I mean, it's an interesting point that the Boer would have been much more effective against Britain precisely if they hadn't been so antagonistic with so many of the African polities in the region. But that, in a sense, is maybe a slightly naive view, because, of course, their antipathy to these African polities was part of their actual rationale.
So the British forces performed very poorly, particularly the two battles on Majuba Hill. How yes. was it that the Boers managed to defeat what on paper should have been a much better drilled force?
Well, I think first of all, the British Army wasn't prepared for the effect of accurate Boer long-range fire. I don't think it's any indication of what might have happened if the war had continued. I mean, something we mentioned last time, and something that indeed was to happen in the Second Boer War, but something, as I said, we've already seen with the Crimean War, is that initial failure and deficiencies, which is exactly what you'd expect at an imperial power. It can't keep state-of-the-art large forces at every point on the imperial periphery. Would probably have been assuaged subsequently. But for the British government in 1881, quite frankly, what's the point? They've got so many other things to think about.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that war...
In particular, they're heading for a big crisis in Egypt. I mean, if you had the choice, what would you put your money on? Trying to sort out the Egypt issue and control of the Suez Canal, or wondering about a few, you know, Boers in the backwaters of southern Africa?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Gladstone's government in London decides that its priority is Egypt. The First Boer War comes to a close. There's still about 400 British soldiers killed in the First Boer War, which...
This is going to sound terrible to you, Graham, but actually that is not a key issue. If your strategy is about prioritisation, something I tried to drum home in my book on strategy of global history, prioritisation entails problems. Mm. It means that sometimes you accept failure in one area in order to concentrate on another. Mm. We are at the present moment, as you know, you're a political commentator, we are seeing the most astonishing instance of that in Britain at the present moment. There may be a significant conflict, maybe a lesser conflict, we don't know, but there may be a significant conflict on the borders of NATO in Ukraine. There may indeed be a similar one used as an opportunity by the Chinese to also take their own lines, and instead of which, the British, with their infinite sense of their priorities, are focusing on who held a party or two. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let us not beat up on people in the past. And let's be clear about this. When you make priorities, choices, people, and they don't work out, people do get killed. Mm-hmm. When they do work out, people get killed as well, incidentally.
So what happened between... 1881 and 1899, when war breaks out in southern Africa again on a much larger scale?
Well, I think you can look at this several different ways. I mean, one of the ways I would look at it is the rising pace of geopolitical confrontation, and in particular, Germany pursuing its place in the sun, which makes southern Africa more contentious for the British. On top of that, the British and indeed the Germans are taking part in speculations as well as talks with the Portuguese about taking over Portugal's empire in southern Africa, Angola and Mozambique, which is also significant. So there's that issue, the geopolitical one, in which the Boers are important. I mean, if the Boers are part of a hostile axis, then the British feel that Cape Colony and the Natal will be imperiled, and they're worried about the broader consequences. There is also, of course, the dependence of the world in a bullion-based system using the gold standard on the production of gold. And that means that gold sources within the British Empire are very important, of which the principal one is Australia. But the liquidity of the British system would benefit greatly from the access to the new gold fields in the Transvaal. And that, again, is significant. And as you probably know, there are difficulties in both the global economy and the British economy at the late 19th century. They're the ones that are to lead Joseph Chamberlain with, you know, using emotive language about the British economy being on the slide. And of course, Joseph Chamberlain is a prominent liberal unionist who's joined the Conservatives. So there are political factors as well. But I think one wants to be clear about this. The idea that the Boer War was a war waged by the British for these purposes needs to be handled with some caution. It was, of course, the Boer Republics that declared war. The Marquess of Salisbury, who was Prime Minister, scarcely wanted a war that wouldn't work out. And the war indeed was to imperil conservative fiscal policies. It was to lead to a significant increase in taxation, which the government didn't want. And in the long term, I think it weakened the conservative, that accordingly weakened the conservative government.
As you say, on paper, the British forces in the Second Boer War had all the strength, and yet the Boers put up a tremendous resistance. How well armed were the Boers? Were they relying purely on their own shotguns as farmers and so on, or were they receiving supplies from sympathetic European or other powers?
Well, they had good rifles with which they'd been supplied. There were trade routes to them via Mozambique, which is one of the reasons why the British government deployed warships in Mozambique waters to stop those. I've actually just found from one of my books here, I've got, this is from an officer who was present at Majuba Hill. This comes from a manuscript source of the period. So he said, he's referring to the problems caused by, quote, bullets from an enemy we could not see. And as a result, quote, the Boer fire so completely dominated us. The Boers are using Mauser magazine rifles with smokeless powder, which makes it very difficult to spot them, you know, in other words, where they're shooting from, and gives them a range. And of course, from their hunting experience, they have an accuracy of fire, which is very deadly against units deployed in the open. So, for example, a classic problem the British encountered initially is the British used a lot of field artillery. They were good at field artillery. But having field artillery in the open, whilst okay against people that don't have accurate fire of their own, was no good at all against people who were able to snipe at you, which was the British experience. A lot of their gunners were shot down in the initial engagement. So the British needed, as indeed they needed when they were engaged against the Maori in their so-called PA, you know, their fortresses, their entrenchments, they needed to get used to fighting in a particular environment. That always causes a challenge. And in the case of the Boers, it caused a particular challenge because the Boers, although, as you point out accurately, out-resourced by their opponents, the Boers nevertheless are able to take the operational and strategic offensive to advance into the British colonies, to attack isolated garrison positions like Ladysmith, Mafeking, and to pose a significant challenge as a result. And you may out-resource an opponent, but, and you recall we discussed this when we did our programme on the American Civil War, when we discussed how the Confederate forces marching north in 1862 and 1863 posed a challenge to the Union. But you cannot impose your strategy readily on your opponents. They may choose to not wait for the timetable in which you're going to build up resources. And I mean, it's very interesting. If you go through Exeter, the largest public statue is a statue of a horse called Blifil. And on the top of it is Buller, who was field marshal, who was in command. And down the bottom, it says, you know, there's a list of his campaigns. Incidentally, the local university, which is full of idiots, or its management is full of idiots, took a lot of interest in trying to knock down the statue of Buller as supposedly a symbol of empire, etc., etc. And a number of a group of idiots argued that he invented concentration camps. Well, he didn't. He wasn't responsible for the incarceration of Boer civilians in the latter stages of the war. And it, you know, it just shows, is rather interesting that these anti-statue people were, as it were, campaigning on behalf of the, you know, the racist Afrikaans. But we'll leave that to one side. Anyway, down the bottom of the statue, it says he saved Natal. And what is that is referring to is the idea that it, the British were really under pressure in the early stages of the war by Boer forces advancing on, as it were, the coastal littoral of southern Africa, which is where the major British trading positions were. Durban, Port Elizabeth, and Cape Town, and the idea being that, you know, the British might be defeated. And that did seem to be a possibility in the early stages of the war.
Mm-hmm. What were the Boer War aims? Complete independence from any level of British interference?
Well, yes, I think you can fairly say that. I mean, in effect, they were fairly independent anyway, but I think it was to consolidate their position. I think it also reflected tensions. I mean, we present the Boers as a unified group, like we present the British as a unified group. There were tensions among the Boers, not least between the Orange Free State and the Transvaal. And in many senses, you could argue whether they were wise to resort to violence in 1899. But that's another issue entirely.
Mm-hmm. How did the war develop? And did the Boer guerrilla tactics, were they deployed from the first, or was that something that evolved as the conflict progressed?
No, the Boers initially engage in position warfare against the British positions. They advance, they do significantly well. You know, they besiege the positions at Kimberley, at Ladysmith, at Mafeking. British generalship isn't really up to it. The sieges, however, which are designed to consolidate Boer control in the contested regions, lead to a loss of Boer momentum. And that throws away the initiative. So in other words, the Boers are able to defeat British relieving columns, and they win a number of battles in so-called Black Week at Stormberg, Magersfontein, and Colenso, and then they go on to do another one at Spion Kop. But they, as it were, their sieges, the whilst you might say they make sense in order to control lines of axes of advance, their sieges throw away their advantage. So having gone on to the operational offensive, and you know, the strategic offensive is declaring war, having gone on to the operational offensive of advancing, they then, as it were, lose that. And that, I think, is very significant. The British, in response, build up their forces and prepare to counterfight. Now, I've got another quotation. This comes from a chap called Colin Ballard of the Ninth Foot. He's referring to the problems at firing at them, at the Boers, at 5,000 yards range. And he talks about the difficulties and how he would prefer to charge. Riding is now the game, he puts it. He would prefer to take and maintain the initiative. And indeed, the British develop techniques for attack, creeping barrages of continuous artillery fire, infantry advances in rushes coordinated with the artillery, and the new generals, Lord Roberts from India, his chief of staff, Herbert Kitchener, who'd made his reputation, of course, at Omdurman in 1898, defeating the Mahdists, they change the situation, they take the initiative, and the Boer field army is defeated. It's trapped and forced to surrender at Paardenberg, and the major towns, Bloemfontein, Johannesburg, and Pretoria, are conquered, and the Transvaal is overrun. So by the end of June 1900, the British have won the conventional war. What then happens is the aftermath. The Boers concentrate on dispersed operations using their mounted infantry. And that's difficult because the British find, you know, that they do not have a concentrated target. And I've got another quote from a British contemporary. This is a British soldier recording in April 1901. Quote, "H Company go off to burn and destroy a farm close by as a carbineer," in other words, a British mounted soldier, "had been shot by a Boer sniping from there." You know, for everybody involved, pretty miserable work. But, you know, that's what you've got. You've got a guerrilla war, and there you've got real problems. Large area, very difficult to impose defeat. You know, you've captured the other side's towns. You've overrun their territory. You're in control of most of their civilians. Most of their troops have surrendered. The war goes on. Mm. Not easy. Not easy at all. The Americans had that problem in the Philippines when, having defeated the Spaniards, they fall out with the Filipinos, and then there is guerrilla warfare against them in a number of the against the Americans in a number of the islands, and the Americans resort to counterterrorism with all counterinsurgency with all the problems that that entails, as I discuss in my book on insurgency warfare.
Mm-hmm. Are there aspects which are even similar to the recent Afghanistan war, in which the territory is mostly in the hands of NATO and allied powers, but actually the insurgency goes on, and the loss of life just becomes, even at a low level, a low continuous level, just becomes, builds up to a continuous drain that no longer there is the political will to sustain?
Well, I mean, you know, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, I would say actually, in the end, the Boers do surrender. I mean, I think that you're dealing with a war that has run out of logic for the Boers, not least because of the significance of elections. You remember I discussed when we were talking about the American Civil War, the significance of the 1864 election in the United States. Well, you get the same thing in Britain. You get the Kharki election in October 1900. The opposition liberals were publicly divided over the merits of the war. Lloyd George, for example, attacking the war, whereas Campbell Bannerman was in favour of what the government was doing. He didn't agree with all of it, but he was willing to support the war. And the result of which is that 163 government supporters were elected unopposed. I mean, that was, you know, really quite remarkable. I mean, not all of the government candidates win. Arthur Conan Doyle, who stands in Edinburgh Central for the government, actually loses. But the majority of government candidates, you know, win. And it's a... I mean, after that, what on earth is the point of the Boers going on?
Mm-hmm. But they, I mean, they do go on for a while. What is the scorched earth policy that eventually brings the war to a conclusion?
Well, I wouldn't call it scorched earth. I mean, that I think is over the top. The British, first of all, they use a blockhouse system of barbed wire fences and small positions. They use composite columns, so that's infantry, artillery and cavalry moving quite fast. Scorched earth is only in response to continued insurgency activity. It's not an arbitrary thing across this whole area. They move people into detention camps, a total of 27,927 Boer civilians died there from disease. The camps were to be subsequently emotively criticised. They bear no comparison whatsoever with the German concentration camps prior to and during World War II, or for that matter, the Spanish ones in Cuba in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. And the Boers, I mean, it was a final and rather decisive drive against the Boers in the Western Transvaal that leads them to capitulate in the spring of 1902. So, you know, there is a pace of British activity. The same thing in Sudan. I mean, it needs to be remembered. I mean, people are apt to forget this, that Omdurman in 1898 leads to the defeat of the Mahdist army and the capture of the capital, Khartoum. Great. If that's your point of view, it does not lead to the end of the war. People tend to forget this. In fact, the Mahdist leader is not defeated until the following year in a cavalry battle, and operations take a while. You know, you don't generally have a equivalent, as people seem to imagine, of a climactic battle, and then everybody goes home.
So 1902, the war finally concludes. What are the consequences? And what are the consequences at two levels? What are the consequences for South Africa? And are there wider consequences for the perception of British military power beyond?
Well, what I would say are the consequences for South Africa is there is a, in the end, a new political dispensation in which the Boers are integrated into the new system, which is probably just as well for British strategic interests, because even so, a small number of them rise on behalf of the Germans in 1914, and there is also to be a degree of opposition by them to participation in World War II. So it's just as well the majority of the Boers are don't take that viewpoint. And it's integrated into British-dominated Southern Africa. On the other hand, that is a British-dominated Southern Africa which has a white ascendancy, and from modern conception, that's unacceptable. So Britain obviously is strengthened by the addition of South Africa. South African forces are important in Britain in World War One, notably in the conquest of Southwest Africa and German East Africa, but also incidentally in Europe, and also the bullion they provide. And South African forces are very important in World War Two, notably in the conquest of Madagascar from Vichy Italian East and East Africa and Italian Libya. So that's very important for Britain strategically. And again, you know, I mean, it exemplifies the point that, you know, people might be as critical as they like about the British Empire, but if you're going to take a global view on merit in history, and you think about the nature of empires, the British Empire was considerably more benign and less malign than the German Empire was to be, or German imperialism was to be. And therefore, it's a jolly good thing from that perspective that that Southern Africa became part of the British dominated world system.
So the consequences for native Africans were what as a consequence? And
well, apartheid isn't brought
to play in the conflict itself.
Yeah, apartheid isn't brought to full fruition until the Afrikaners dominate the political system after World War II. The native Africans have played a role in the conflict in support of the British, but they let's make it clear, it is a subordinate role. I'm not sure that you would necessarily say that its significance would be emphasized as other than in terms of modern cultural politics. I mean, it's also worth bearing in mind that the British benefited in the Boer War, Second Boer War, by imperial troops from Canada, Australia, and you know, New Zealand and elsewhere in the Dominions. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that Southern Africa, after the Boer War, was an area which is largely self-governing under British hegemony, that a lot of black communities within that context are essentially disadvantageously self-governing, that's how I would put it, and that situation deteriorates with the onset of apartheid. Mm-hmm. I've got a quotation here from, this is interesting, from the Times on the 27th of December 1899, a letter signed Colonel, and he writes, the modern method of fortifications introduced with the breech-loading rifle, he means by that as opposed to loading a musket or rifle from the barrel, is based upon the practical indestructibility by modern artillery fire of properly designed earthworks and the improbability of an attacking force being able to rush a properly prepared position defended by a sufficient number of troops armed with the breech-loading rifle. This improbability became impossibility now that the magazine rifle is substituted for the breech loader until the defences shall have been seriously injured by artillery fire. So, going back to what we were talking about at the outset, although this should be seen as a late imperial war, there are also intimations in it of what is to be significant in World War One, where, as you may know, the majority of the troops killed in World War One were actually killed by artillery fire.
Professor Jeremy Black, for taking us through the wars of Southern Africa in the 1880s and at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, the two Boer Wars. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.